Recording 68. Practice listening. Test 1. Section 1. Choosing flatmates. You will hear a man and a woman talking about who they would like as their flatmates. Read the example.
Okay, Alex, let's make a decision now. I've got to head off to my parents' place for the weekend, and we'll need our two new flatmates to move in soon. Who do we have again?
Mauro, Spring, Katia, Lucy, and that lovely girl from Turkey. What was her name?
The answer is Turkey. On this occasion only, the first part of the conversation is played twice. Before you listen again, you have 30 seconds to read questions 1 to 5.
Okay, Alex, let's make a decision now. I've got to head off to my parents' place for the weekend, and we'll need our two new flatmates to move in soon. Who do we have again?
Mauro, Spring, Katia, Lucy, and that lovely girl from Turkey. What was her name?
Aziza. I think she's my first choice. She seemed very mature.
She did, didn't she?
She also said she'd shared a house in Istanbul for 2 years before she came here, so she knows what flatting is all about.
That's true. While you were on the phone, I had a talk to her about her part-time job as a telephone counsellor for the Turkish community. It sounds quite steady and well enough paid, so she won't have any problems with the rent, unlike our old flatmate, Tina.
Who would you choose next?
How about a guy?
I don't know. Neither of them was that impressive. I mean, Mauro from Mexico was a party animal. Remember, he only found our place because he knew there was a certain nightclub nearby. And Spring seemed spoilt to me. He told me that his father in Hong Kong paid all his parking and speeding fines, and he ate out at restaurants almost every night. I doubt he's got any idea how to cook.
That leaves us with Katia and Lucy then. And I found Katia rather shy. We hardly know anything about her.
I think she's the strong, silent type. But while you were showing Mauro around, I had a chat to her. She's in her 3rd year of environmental engineering.
Really? She's going to be an engineer?
Yes. In fact, she won a prize at university last year for a model she made.
That does sound interesting. But what about Mauro? We could do with someone social. I'm sure he'd be keen on our Sunday get-togethers. He promised me he knew how to barbecue. Plus, he's working as a security guard at night, so he'll be around during the day. It's not a bad idea having someone in the flat while we're all out.
I don't know. If he works night shift, he might sleep during the day. This year, I'll need to practice the piano here in the mornings for my performance course. It's likely my music would disturb him.
That's a fair point.
Before you listen to the rest of the conversation, you have 30 seconds to read questions 6 to 10.
What's wrong with three women living here, Alex? I think Katia would be fine. She won't be so shy once she gets to know us.
You know, Julie, I can't give a rational explanation for why I didn't take to Katia. I'd just prefer someone else. Why don't we reconsider Lucy? I know you were annoyed because she came an hour late, but I rather liked her.
She's doing a master's in public health, isn't she?
Yes. I think she's quite a serious person. And since she's been a nurse, you'd hope she'd be clean.
Yes, you would. Didn't Lucy mention she had a boyfriend?
I don't think so.
I don't want anyone with a boyfriend. Remember Tina?
How could I ever forget her? She really did have us wrapped around her little finger.
She certainly did. I'm so glad she's gone. Yes, Lucy seemed nice and normal, and she'd probably get on with Aziza. I think they're the same age.
I've just had a thought. We need to choose three people. Someone we like may have found another place. I love our flat, but it's some distance from the city and not everyone likes an old building.
So who should we have?
How about Aziza and Lucy and Marrow as reserve?
I agree with your top two, but I think Katia should be backup.
I'll call Aziza and Lucy. And if one of them has made another commitment, we'll think again.
You now have 30 seconds to check your answers. That is the end of Section 1. Section 2. Designing a Veranda Garden. You will hear a woman giving part of a workshop on garden design. Before you listen, you have 30 seconds to read questions 11 to 14.
Welcome back to the workshop. In this part, we're going to look at making a veranda garden. These days, few people can afford to live in a house with a garden, but we can all create a tranquil space on a balcony or veranda. It has long been my belief that a veranda garden softens the sharp lines of the urban environment. Greenery, blossom, and fruit, which attract birds and insects, bring us closer to nature. If well designed, its mood changes with each season, and it may reflect Japanese spiritual traditions that help us feel at peace. Of course, everyone's needs are different. Perhaps you'd like more privacy, or to conceal an unsightly building next door. Perhaps there's too much glare from the setting sun. In these instances, fast-growing plants in strategic places will be your main ambition. One client of mine, whose husband was blind, chose scented plants for their veranda garden. He sat out there every night, delighting in the fragrances. Another client of mine opted for an area of raked gravel, with one large ornamental rock reminiscent of a famous temple garden in Kyoto. From a more practical perspective, a low-maintenance veranda garden will increase the value of your property. You may be surprised to know that around the world there's a movement in big cities for roof, terrace and veranda gardens, so buyers won't be put off by your creativity at all. But on to our design. I'm assuming your veranda is about 1.8 metres deep and 4.5 metres wide. If it's larger than this, all the better. If it's smaller, you'll need to plan more carefully, foregoing some features. It doesn't matter which floor of the building you're on, but if you've got a view, you might consider how tall particular plants grow. The handout I've given you details a range of plant characteristics. For example, a loquat tree grows to 6 meters, but an azalea bush only reaches 3. Loquats bear fruit as well, which you might like to eat, or you might find a chore to pick up and dispose of. In my design, I've chosen a Japanese maple as the centerpiece, since I love the way its foliage changes colour in autumn. In a large pot, a maple will grow to about 4 meters. The garden design I'm going to show you is quite high maintenance at the start. I'd say you'd have to spend 3 hours a week tending it. But after a year or so, it virtually takes care of itself.
Before you listen to the rest of the talk, you have 30 seconds to read questions 15 to 20.
So, let's get started. Your veranda probably has a concrete floor and a low brick or concrete wall around it. It's more than likely you've got a drain in the top right corner. The floor of the veranda garden is the first priority. In my design, I've chosen 4 different surfaces to create a sense of space, and because they react in different ways to light and rain. In a small area, you want to maximise texture. I've chosen practical square concrete pavers for the area under the table and chairs, and elsewhere, large irregular stones sourced from a river, and small round stones not much bigger than pebbles. There's also an area of sand which is marked with the letter H in your diagram. You'll find this might be popular with your pet if you have one. After laying the floor, most people construct a wooden or aluminium frame over the concrete wall. Onto this, bamboo is attached for plants to climb up. In front of the bamboo, wooden planters or boxes may be positioned. The choice of plants in these is up to you. But again, think about height, shape, loss of leaves, fruit, scent, and cost. Although maples are expensive, they're beautiful, and I've put one in the centre. After you've planted, you'll probably want to buy a really nice set of outdoor furniture. Stackable plastic chairs are a no-no, as in my view, they're part of the ugly, mass-produced culture we're trying to escape. I also discourage people from putting a barbecue on their veranda because they're so seldom used and they take up such a lot of space. Some people do add features like a small pond or bird bath or a stone lantern to their newly landscaped area. So, happy designing! Any questions?
You now have 30 seconds to check your answers. That is the end of Section 2. Section 3. Architecture Essay. You will hear 2 students discussing an essay they are writing together about architecture. Before you listen, you have 30 seconds to read questions 21 to 25.
Hi, Helen. How are you?
I'm actually pretty excited about the research I've been doing. I've found out heaps about Art Deco architecture in New Zealand. While all the major cities there have pockets of Art Deco, it seems that Napier, a small city on the east coast of the North Island, is considered one of the world's purest Art Deco enclaves. There are so many examples of the style still visible today.
Really? I've been concentrating on Bandung, which is in central Java in Indonesia. It is also a major Art Deco city. Unfortunately, it hasn't been preserved so well, and in the race to modernise, many marvellous buildings have gone under the wrecker's ball.
How do you think we should structure our essay? Should we write about New Zealand first or Indonesia?
Art Deco appeared in Bandung in the 1920s, but from what I've read, it didn't make it to Napier until much later. If we choose a chronological scheme, then Indonesia would go first. But I'm in favour of writing our essay using thematic similarities and differences.
That's a good idea. Let's identify what the two cities have in common. From what I've discovered, in both places, Art Deco architects combined a new European aesthetic with native elements.
Yes, they did.
In New Zealand, Maori motifs were used as decoration. The Maoris are the indigenous people who lived in New Zealand before it became a British colony. There's a sort of spiral symbol called a koru, and there are zigzags, like patterns from Maori weaving, both of which were incorporated into Art Deco buildings. There's a bank in the middle of the city and an old headquarters for a tobacco company, both with gorgeous carved stucco facades that utilise these motifs.
Indonesia was also a colony, a Dutch colony. I understand almost all of the architects in the Art Deco period were Dutch. And as you said, they were influenced by a new aesthetic in Europe, but they were also affected by native architectural styles. At ITB, the famous technical institute in Bandung, there are Art Deco roofs that imitate traditional Javanese mosque or temple roofs.
That's interesting. I know that the city of Napier was rebuilt in 1931 after a massive earthquake, and since people wanted the town to feel like an optimistic new place, they chose Art Deco for many of their buildings. But I've no idea why Bandung has so much of the style.
I was quite puzzled about the prevalence of Art Deco myself. After fossicking in the library in some old journals, I learnt that there was a plan that never eventuated to move the capital from Jakarta to Bandung, so lots of public buildings were commissioned around the same time, the early 1920s.
That's curious. I thought the majority of the famous Art Deco buildings in Bandung were large hotels or private houses.
I think the split is 50-50. Private and public. Certainly the campus of ITB was enlarged then. College education for the rich expanded in the 1920s, and the local tourist industry was taking off as well. You're right, we've got tourism to thank for the grand Art Deco hotels like the Savoy and the Preinger, built in the late 20s and early 30s. Photos of the foyer and ballroom of the Preinger are so romantic.
Before you listen to the rest of the conversation, you have 30 seconds to read questions 26 to 30.
OK, let's have a paragraph on the historical reasons for these two cities featuring Art Deco, then another on what Art Deco actually is.
It's a French term, isn't it?
Yes. One influence was the 1925 Paris International Expo of Decorative Arts. But Art Deco was chiefly a reaction against the previous style of Art Nouveau, which had held sway from the end of the 19th century. That was all about nature and fluid forms, whereas Art Deco celebrated the machine age and the geometric.
There are lots of influences, aren't there?
Should we include anything on building materials?
Definitely. They were different from the past. More concrete was used, more steel, more glass. These days, people rave about Art Deco, but at the time, it was considered somewhat low class because the materials are quite inexpensive and fabrication was rapid. These concepts were in stark contrast with some of the previous notions of craftsmanship in building. Yes, we'll certainly need a paragraph on materials.
You now have 30 seconds to check your answers. That is the end of Section 3. Section 4. Wetsuits. You will hear a lecture on wetsuits. Before you listen, you have 45 seconds to read questions 31 to 40.
Welcome to the Monday Design Forum. Today's item is the wetsuit, used by water sports enthusiasts, by surfers, divers, canoeists, and long-distance swimmers. Long distance, mind. I'll tell you about the great swimsuit debate a little later. The reason I chose the wetsuit for a case study is that it exemplifies two design themes: the importance of materials and reliable production techniques. I may not look the sporty type, but I've been diving for 20 years. In that time, I've had 8 wetsuits. Like much else after 1945, technology has just kept on changing. My first wetsuit was French and very expensive. It was made entirely from sponge rubber. It looked great, but it was horrible to get into and out of, and it weighed a ton. In general, first-generation wetsuits were liable to rip when being removed and were rather heavy. Pretty soon, I swapped my Pesch Spore for a lighter neoprene version. So, what's neoprene? It's a synthetic material considerably lighter than rubber. It's still spongy because it contains tiny bubbles of nitrogen gas. Since gases have lower thermal conductivity than liquids or solids, that is, they don't transport heat well, the body heat of a person wearing neoprene escapes only very slowly through the material. This means that a diver in a neoprene suit stays warmer longer than one in a suit made from rubber. Wetsuits are a recent innovation and were invented in the U.S., but there's no real agreement by whom or when. Hugh Bradner tried to patent a design in 1951. However, he was unsuccessful. The Maestral brothers and the O'Neills from California were all making and selling neoprene suits to the burgeoning diving and surfing community by 1953. In my view, it's irrelevant who the inventor of the wetsuit was. What is significant is that post-war prosperity brought more free time and a boom in sporting goods. But back to my collection of wetsuits. Since neoprene is fragile with all those gas bubbles, it's hard to join pieces of it together. Any hole, however tiny, just grows and grows. This means sewing with needle and thread is all but impossible. Therefore, early wetsuits were made by gluing or taping their seams. My first neoprene suit was black with yellow tape. I thought this yellow tape was to make me more visible underwater, but in fact, it joined the body-hugging sections together without letting water in. While neoprene itself was warmer and lighter than rubber, the taped seams proved to be a weakness, and I tore three of my suits. Suit number five was much stronger. Aside from being bright blue, my new suit came with Lycra backing, which was a technological breakthrough. This meant my suit was a bit like a sandwich. There was Lycra on the outside and inside, so putting on and taking off were easier, and there was neoprene in the middle for insulation. By the early 1980s, there'd been a revolution in wetsuit production. No glue, no tape, but a new kind of stitching. In fact, a technique called blind stitching had been developed. With this, a curved needle in a sophisticated sewing machine is used. The stitching dips into the Lycra backing, the top bread of the sandwich, but doesn't pierce the neoprene filling inside. Remember, neoprene is susceptible to tearing, so covering it with Lycra was a smart idea. Suddenly, wetsuits were warm, light, and durable. This revolution is important for design students because without this sewing technique, wetsuits would have continued to rip and remained the preserve of the rich. In design, you want a product that's unique, reliable, and affordable. I admit I'm still wearing my neoprene suit from 3 years ago, but I've heard there are now models on the market with inbuilt heating panels, and yet others made from a mix of fibers that include merino wool and titanium. At the start of this lecture, I mentioned there'd been a swimsuit controversy. Essentially, a wetsuit not only keeps a person warm, but also provides a swimmer with a lift in the water. Unsurprisingly, swimmers wearing wetsuits break more records, so the International Olympic Committee has declared that only long-distance swimmers can use wetsuits. In short events, they're banned. That's all from me. I'm off to the beach.
You have 30 seconds to check your answers. That is the end of section 4. You now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to your answer sheet. Section 4. Learning styles. You will hear a lecture on a way of teaching called learning styles. Before you listen, you have 45 seconds to read questions 31 to 40.
Good afternoon. Today we're going to ask the question, what helps students learn? We've all been students from an early age, and we all remember teachers and schools we loved. Considerable research has been done into factors that contribute to learning, and there's certainly a connection between how we feel about our teachers and how well we do in education. A teacher's own knowledge and passion for a subject is instantly communicated to his or her students, and this translates into successful learning outcomes. The teacher's personal qualities of warmth, humour, fairness, and dedication are also significant. Some educators believe the rapport between the teacher and the student is the single most important factor in learning. Research has also shown that the classroom environment affects performance. Children in classes with a small number of students and those in clean, warm, spacious, and pleasantly decorated classrooms score consistently higher on aptitude tests. But in the 1970s, another idea swept through education like wildfire. Millions of teachers, including me, were trained in this method. Basically, it maintained that students learn best when they use one particular learning style. The first famous learning style theory was proposed by Kolb. He divided learners into four personality types. Two of these tended towards abstract conceptualization, while the other two favored concrete experience. He claimed if teachers devised activities related to personality type, learners would be more likely to retain information. Later, Fleming developed a similar theory, which was the one taken up by education ministries around the world. His model is known as the VARC model, or the Visual, Auditory, Reading-Writing and Kinesthetic Learning Styles model. Fleming said visual learners benefit from material being presented in diagrammatic form or in photographs. Boys are often considered more visual learners than girls. Auditory learners prefer to pick up new concepts from listening either to their teacher or another source. Class discussions or debates often suit them. Reading-writing learners do fine with the traditional methods which rely heavily on these skills. Kinesthetic or tactile learners learn faster through experience. For example, if they build models, conduct experiments, act out plays, or go on excursions. Fleming believed that less than half of students benefit from reading and writing alone, and that others should be taught according to their preferences for visual, sound-based, or movement-based activities. Let's fast forward to the 1990s. Chris Jackson is a neuropsychologist. He's interested in changes in the brain as a result of learning. Using MRI scans, Jackson declared that Fleming's VARC model was inadequate. He concluded that four other factors influence learning. These are goal setting, diligence, concentrated reading, and being emotionally intelligent. In 2007, Sia Darty supported Jackson. She added that considering what a student's achievement will be is by far the most effective way to learn. Making a child understand what he or she will be able to do makes it easier for the steps along the way to be learnt. But let's go back to Fleming's VARC model for a moment and consider it from a teaching perspective. Deciding which students are visual and which like moving around takes time. Developing specific activities is even more laborious. Furthermore, children these days need to learn rather more than children only 30 years ago. The world is a more complex and competitive place. Besides which, most exams, national and international, have little interest in the visual or kinesthetic, preferring answers that are written or spoken. Recent experiments with VARC, in ideal situations, have produced results no better than using traditional teaching methods. So, back to the question I posed at the beginning. What helps students learn? It appears the significant factors remain: the classroom environment, the teacher's personal qualities, the student's relationship with the teacher, and, above all, each student's long-term goals or belief in achievement. In my view, VARC has burdened teachers with extra preparation, pigeonholed many learners, and been a diversion from the main game.
You have 30 seconds to check your answers. That is the end of section 4. You now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to your answer sheet.